Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Hey, Chris.
Hello. We are back.
We are back talking about a really fun topic, Dupuytren's disease. Do you have anything you'd like to share before we get started?
Of course. Well, thank you to at the hand OT for leaving us this great review on iTunes. We really, really appreciate it. 5-star review. All 5 of those are probably for Chuck. On the way to be a CHT. Love listening to these guys while driving to work. And that is our goal in life, is to be the NPR of hand surgery.
We want some driveway moments. We want you to finish listening to Chris talk about nerve before you get out of the car. You can't leave him hanging. Did you have a good case this week or last week you'd like to share, or sometime? Anything you want to enlighten us with?
I had a fun case recently. One of the reasons why I love doing Plexus stuff is being able to work in a team. And I recently did a case with our partner, Dave Brogan. And we just had so much fun doing it. It was a Plexus, and the imaging really helped us out before surgery, because I wasn't sure whether the nerve was going to be in continuity or not. It was from a ballistic injury. And usually the nerve is intact, but beat up. But the MRI was really helpful. And our team at WashU was great about communicating what they thought a nerve was in discontinuity. And indeed it was. So while David was working at the same time doing the nerve transfers below the clavicle, I was up in the neck. Typically how it works in our practice is I'm the one digging in scar and he gets nice pristine tissue. And I never let him forget that. And then I had to go harvest the sural nerve. So I'm like holding the leg up and he's doing this very elegant and beautiful dissection. But it was a joyful case, finished in really good time. And it was one of those cases where you looked at each other like, yeah, I think we really helped somebody, and it was a lot of fun at the same time. So you usually don't get both of those in the same day for a Plexus.
No, that's awesome. You know what? A little teaser for all you nerve people. I harvested a nerve graft this week too.
And wow.
You're going to have to wait till the next episode when I enlighten you on how and why.
I'm sure I'm going to have to hear about somebody holding the leg. I'll never, ever live down the point where Marty Boyer had to harvest sural nerve for me during one of the pre-Brogan years.
I can only imagine.
I still think he has a crick in the neck that he shows me every time. Well, I love you, Marty. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I don't miss those days, I have to say. All right, Dupuytren's. We're back.
So let's jump back into our case. We got our 67-year-old gentleman who can't put his hand in his pocket. But now he comes in saying, I think I have what John Elway has, and I want exactly what John Elway had done. I want the collagenase.
So here's how I respond to that. First of all, I love John Elway too. The whole concept of marketing, the mass marketing of procedures, even medications, but I think we're more accustomed to true medication marketing, but total hip, prostheses, it's just a fascinating thing to me. And I can tell you that when collagenase was first introduced or pre-market, I had a number of conversations with private equity folks with their trying to understand, one hand surgeon's perspective. And it was really interesting for me to participate in those. Clearly, there's a lot of money invested in collagenase and its success. And I don't know. I think the literature is starting to come out, and we can talk about that a little bit. But I do have my standard shtick that I go over with patients. What's your general thoughts behind before we get into specifics?
Yeah, I tell them that our goal, at least my goal in practice in treating this, is to try and break down that cord. I can't eliminate the cord entirely with no matter what we do. There's no cure for this. But I'm trying to take, this mechanical issue that they have and alleviate it. And clearly it is biased by what I like to do and how I've been trained. But I tell them I can do this very precisely with a needle procedure here in the office, or we can inject the drug into the cord. And my concern is that it may go to other places. Now, that is probably an overblown concern. The safety profile of collagenase has been studied very rigorously. And I think the safety profile is reasonable. And in comparison to a needle laparotomy, is also reasonable. The results, my general appraisal of the literature is that it is basically equivalent to a needle. And to be honest with you, the thing that hangs me up is the cost.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as a cost-conscious surgeon. I'm not perfect, but I do consider how I spend money, whether it be in the operating room or in the clinic. And it is true. The cost analyses that have been done, I think you can have an upfront investment if it is a, you know, longer term successful intervention, but that's not been proven to be true.
Honestly, this is probably where we're going to deviate from some of our colleagues who are not in academic practice. Because I remember actually sitting in this room meeting with somebody, you know, a representative for the collagenase, and trying to understand the delivery model in terms of how the drug gets from the manufacturer to our clinic. And clearly, if you're in a group practice, there is an advantage to purchasing this medicine, storing it, and then distributing it yourself. And that is a financial advantage. And I may be, you know, overly simplifying the cost model, but I can see how this could financially work out well for some practices.
Yeah, that's true. So to me, I the most helpful piece of literature which reinforced what has been my impression was Marco Rizzo's paper in the Journal of Hand Surgery last year. And let me just read the conclusions. And I don't like to just jump to the conclusions, but I think it does summarize what's important. So treatment with collagenase resulted in the highest rate of re-intervention at 2 years, comparable re-intervention rates to needle laparotomy at 5 years, and the highest cumulative cost. The needle laparotomy was the least expensive and resulted in longer duration before re-intervention compared to collagenase. More severe PIP joint contractures and a younger age at initial intervention were predictive of re-intervention after collagenase and needle laparotomy. Fasciectomy has a high initial cost, but the lowest re-intervention rate. And I think that fits. And that's what I tell patients. I don't have anything against collagenase. It doesn't have a place in my practice. I really like the needle. But if patients are looking for the longest disease-free interval, then it's an open fasciectomy. It is. But it comes with short-term both monetary cost and cost to the patient. And that is more time to recover, more therapy, et cetera.
So, I mean, does collagenase have any role in your treatment armamentarium right now?
It does not. And if patients really want it after our conversation, one of our plastic surgery colleagues here at WashU does it and does it well. And I am more than happy to send that patient to our colleague. But I don't think it makes sense to offer personally. I don't think it makes sense for me to offer three different treatments. And I like the kind of way it shakes out in my practice.
It's interesting. I talked to patients about the outcomes, very similar to how you described. And I talked to them about the cost, and they've already been told that Medicare covers it. So that's an interesting piece of information that creeps into it, into the, you know, their psych, you know, the psychology of that decision for them. And I then further, you know, dissuade them from doing it because, you know, but if they feel strongly, I will refer them elsewhere. I mean, my personal experience with the collagenase was when I was a resident. And, you know, our center was involved in some of the studies. It was very big in New York, obviously the marketing part of that too. And then we were talking in the last episode about being a trainee and not being able to get your hands on things. The VA. So I was up at our VA and I was a chief resident and had the blessing from our faculty. And we started doing some collagenase for some of the vets. And I liked the results that I saw there. But I also saw all that was entailed with that. And as we learn more about the clinical outcomes, so that was probably, 8-10 years ago, something like that. So as you learn more about the clinical outcomes now and the results not being tremendously different and in some ways not as good, I don't think it's worth the squeeze.
I think that's well said. And I do think what you shared about the VA and your experience as a resident is important. And I think, you know, we all are colored by our early successes with whatever we do. Right. And it doesn't matter if it's a surgical procedure or non-operative care, but if we have success with a few patients early, then it's going to impact us. And that's what impacted me with in favor of the needle procedure. And it's why I've continued to do it. One of the things I think is challenging, more so with some patients than others, is just helping them to understand that unlike many things we deal with in hand surgery, we cannot cure Dupuytren's. And I spend time explaining that. And I think it's really important. You know, the analogy that this is a tumor is not the easiest to share, but it might be the right one. And we can get into the biology and the myofibroblasts and all that.
And I have cancer.
Right. Yeah. So that's the danger. But the fact
I stay far away from that. I mean, you know, I even struggle with bringing kind of the what this could be conversation in when I'm doing a ganglion in counseling about that. And it is not a fun thing to try to bring up.
No, you're right. And I think that I don't go calling it a tumor, but I really emphasize that we can't cure it. It's going to come back. It's just a matter of how long before that happens.
So in all fairness, for those listeners that haven't had any experience with collagenase, my rudimentary understanding of it, recollection of it, is that, you know, you're taking a chemical and injecting it into the cord with the goal of essentially disintegrating this cord with the assistance of some gentle passive manipulation, which occurs, at least the way that it was originally described, is supposed to occur at a follow-up visit. One of the issues that was being described early on were potential flexor tendon issues with the collagenase seeping into that area around there and causing some ruptures of flexor tendons. Now, that concern has been, I think, decreased over time as the safety profile has become more proven. But the skin tear thing, I think, is real. And I think the addition of a chemical instead of a purely, you know, kind of percutaneous type of intervention adds to that skin tear risk. Has that been your experience too? That's the biggest thing I have to counsel patients about.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's safe in the right hands. I think the risks are very low, and I wouldn't stress about flexor tendons in 2020 with this in the right, you know, with the right provider doing the injection. But skin tears are still a legitimate issue. The need for a second visit for manipulation, the potential discomfort of a second a visit during the manipulation. Those are all factors that, again, has led both you and I away from the use of collagenase. But again, for some listeners, it may be the right choice, and I don't find fault with that.
Agreed. So what's the role of surgery for you?
So, you know, one of the things that we see, you know, the paradigm of hand surgery has changed. So, for example, the use of the classic techniques for rheumatoid surgery is gone, right? It's just so infrequent because of the introduction of disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. That was a big part of my fellowship. It was even bigger before my fellowship, but now it's just so rare that we do rheumatoid surgery. And the Dupuytren surgery has really dramatically decreased. And there are, you know, Dupuytren surgery is highly educational for surgical technique. And it's a loss for our fellows not to do a large number of those procedures. Do you see it that way?
I do. You know, I think that the technique parts of it are, you know, everything matters there. It's the handling of the skin. It's the handling of the bundle. It's the knowing your anatomy, where things are supposed to be, and then not always relying on where they're supposed to be, but triangulating in a field. I agree. But it does have a limited role in my practice now. For me, I'm reserving surgery because I'm not using a needle for PIP contractors. I'll use surgery for those. What about you? When are you going to the OR?
Yeah, so it's recurrent disease in a patient who doesn't want to consider a needle, or in a patient where I don't think a needle is going to be successful. So the cords that give me pause are certainly spiral cords, although I will tackle those. Retrovascular cords, when I can't even palpate a cord, you know, that's a problem. So maybe I can feel a pretendinous cord affecting the MP joint, but I can't determine why there's a PIP flexion contracture. Well, then I'm not going to tackle it with a needle procedure. Those are the main indications. When skin involvement is severe, that is a typical indication for me, and I shared one of those at conference recently. I probably do 8 needles for every 2 open procedures that I do. Just a dramatic shift. What about you?
It's probably even less than that to me, to be honest with you. But you know, I find the OR to be very enjoyable. Now, you know, I know that we're always worried about the neurovascular bundle in these conditions that are more severe. I still will go and do it wide awake, local anesthesia and a tourniquet using lidocaine with epi. I get it. That sounds like, you know, well, why are you doing that? You're worried about neurovascular injury. But in my practice, I tend not to have those crazy, crazy ones where once you stretch out the finger, they get, you know, you're worried about stretch on the bundle. And I, even a couple of weeks ago, did a really interesting one where I found an ADM cord, and dissecting everything out and releasing that ADM cord was incredibly gratifying. And I love showing that to the patient on the table.
I believe it. I have not yet done it that way, but I will consider it in the right patient and the right, you know, disease profile. So my general routine, I work from, you know, proximal to distal, try to find the nerve proximally. It's incumbent on us to manage the nerve and the artery, especially with the spiral cords, deal with the easy stuff, so to speak, and then tackle more distally in the joint. It's pretty darn rare that a joint release is necessary. And the literature is clear. If you have to open the joint, you can expect less satisfying results long-term, maybe 50% of maintenance of improvement that you get in the operating room, which is disappointing. And lately I find that I almost never have to open the joint. Sometimes I have to gently manipulate the joint, but rarely do I actually do a boilerplate release or accessory collateral release or anything like that. So I've been happy.
Yeah. I think that with the, you know, in terms of how much to correct, while as a surgeon, both with the needle and with surgery, I love to get the finger all the way straight. I've been impressed with what patients are happy with, meaning with a less than perfect result from, you know, purely objective joint angle. They're just really happy because they're able to use their hand again. They're able to shake hands. They're able to put their hand in their pocket. It's just not a nuisance anymore. So you have helped them in that way.
Absolutely. And then if I do take a patient to the operating room, you know, I use corner stitches. I use a combination typically of dissolving and non-resorbable stitches. I see them back at 2 weeks, but I start therapy in those patients at 5 to 7 days. And that may be controversial. I like the idea of in a really severely affected patient, splinting in full or near full extension, letting the finger rest, and then getting them into therapy, both for nighttime extension splinting, but also working on flexion during the day. What's your post-operative protocol?
So I will have them, so the wide awake ones, I have them go directly from surgery to therapy and have the therapist make them a splint. It's just so much better than what I can make, to be honest with you. Start motion after, basically start motion right away, full-time night extension splint, and wear it during the day as much as they can. And that night extension splint stays, probably a month, to be honest with you. It might be too much. But, you know, I let them take them off during the day and work on their fingers and do whatever they need to do.
Yeah. And, you will have, no matter how careful you are intraoperatively, there will be skin healing problems in this patient population, especially when the skin is involved. And so that's why the recovery period can be unpredictable. I like to share with patients by 2 weeks, typically the skin is healed and you will increase your activities based on comfort level thereafter. But it is unpredictable with a big zigzag incision and the like.
Yeah, I make sure to tell them ahead of time, I'm not taking everything out. We're not getting rid of this disease by any means. We are going to, surgical precision, so to say, like we're going to have a very targeted strike to get your finger straight. And with doing it awake, I show them what I've done and I say, okay, this is what you have right now. Is that good? And that helps a lot.
That is super important. And I don't have my patients awake, but what I do before surgery is not only do I identify the limb we're working on with a big yes, but I draw my surgical incision, and I explain what part of the disease process we're going at. Look, I'd like to take it all out as well, but there are certain patients where we will not. And drawing that incision, I think, helps patients to understand before surgery where I will be working and, more importantly, where I will not be working.
As an aside, I think drawing your incision before surgery is really helpful in general. It helps set expectations appropriately. I try to do it in the office with a pen, and then in the holding area when I mark, I tend to draw a rough estimation of the incision. That's something that I think it was Scott Wolf did when I was a resident, and I've noticed that some of the faculty here do it too. I think it just sets expectations.
I love it. I try to do it every time. And not only does it set expectations, it also is a double check on what you're working on. So if we're doing two triggers, I mark both fingers with a yes, and I also mark the incision. It's just yet another reminder to keep us out of trouble. One thing we didn't talk about was using therapy with a needle procedure. I tend to do it in splint patients at night for up to 3 months, but nothing during the day. Do you use therapy in a splint after needle procedures?
Yeah. So therapy right afterwards, pretty similar protocol, to be honest with you, to what I described after surgery. They go from having a needle go directly upstairs. and have the splint made for them. You know, I think also that can help with some of the residual joint contracture or stiffness that you have, trying to splint that out. I know that, you know, some of our partners will do a needle and then use some kind of splint or even, you know, one of the digit widget kind of things to get the finger a little bit straighter before tackling any residual disease. So I think there's a role for therapy there.
Yeah, and that's a great point with the digit widget. I personally have no experience with that, but you're right. That is another popular treatment option. Well, I think it's popular. A couple of our partners do it. I just have never used that technique, but it's another reasonable alternative, which we have not discussed.
So the Dupuytren's conversation will continue with, I don't think we've ever done a three-parter.
Oh my God.
But, you know, I think that there was a lot to cover here, and I think we're going to have our special guest, Charlie Eaton, coming on the podcast pretty soon.
Perfect. Yeah, this was fun as usual. We kept nerve out of it largely, although you worked it in a couple of times, I think.
I think you might have worked it in actually.
All right, this was fun. Thank you once again.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at Chris DMD, spelled DY. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.